You're listening to the La Jolla Cosmetic Podcast with the LJC Chief Community Officer, Monique Ramsey.
Well, welcome everyone. I'm your host, Monique Ramsey, for the La Jolla Cosmetic Podcast, where dreams become real. And today I have the pleasure to speak with Dr. Lori Saltz, board certified plastic surgeon, and the person who I go back the farthest with, and we're looking at a 30-year relationship now. So Dr. Saltz, today we're going to talk about breast augmentation surgery, and specifically for women who are thinking about getting breast implants for the first time. So welcome, and let me have you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, as you've already mentioned, I've been at the center at La Jolla Cosmetic Surgery Center for over 30 years. And I've always been interested more in breast and body work. And over the years, I've sort of divested myself of facial work and things like that. So my practice is primarily breast and body. And I've done literally thousands of breast augmentations on first-time patients and probably almost as much on other patients coming back after when they need new implants or they've had children and they need a lift. Or so I have a lot of experience and I've learned a tremendous amount over the last three decades. Plus, our technology and our knowledge about breast implants has increased considerably to our benefit so that we have a better procedure to offer first-time patients. And I'm really excited about that and I love doing it.
And so what's the first question that most women have when they start thinking about breast augmentation surgery?
Most of the women, by the time I've seen them, have already been online and done a ton of reading and talked to a bunch of friends or their hairdresser or their doctor or somebody. So they already have a lot of thoughts in mind, and some of them actually know everything they think they want. Mm. I think that the first thing women think about, there's one of two things. The first and the most frequent is that I don't like the size of my breasts. They're too small. They're out of proportion. One might be bigger than the other. So it's size. And then a secondary thing that we get for special kinds of breasts that we know as soon as they say, I don't like the shape of my breasts. I'm not really concerned about the size as much as the shape. But then we know what kind of breasts they have, and that's a different discussion. But those are the two. Sizes being the biggest one. And how am I going to decide what size? Or they have a size in mind. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, cup sizes are not standardized anymore. Oh. It's not like batteries where a AA is a AA, no matter which company you buy your batteries from. But cup sizes don't work that way. So if you go to Victoria's Secret, she upsizes what we call vanity sizes, all of her bras. So just about everybody gets to be a double D.
Oh,
at all possible. And women come in and they're wearing bras they think they want to wear. They'll go, you know, I'm wearing a D cup bra or I'm wearing a C cup bra. And you'll come in and it's totally empty. And their breast is this little puddle in the bottom of the cup. And you're going, no, sweetheart, you're really an A. We can make you a C if you really want to be a
right.
C and fill this bra or one that's bigger.
Uh-huh.
So cup size is really hard for us to work with.
So then how do you determine the right size and what tools do you have to help the patient kind of try on a size?
Well, the first thing, and I think it's an important thing, is we do a lot of measurements when the patients come into the office. And that tells us the most important measurement we take is how wide is their breast. We call it the base width from side to side. How wide is your breast? Because if the implant is wider than that, you may see rippling. You will definitely feel the implant along the sides and the bottom because those are the parts that aren't covered by the muscle. And so we do the measurements and we look at the numbers of the measurements of the implants. We have the charts there in the room and we say, this is the size range that would look good in your particular breasts.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's going to change with age and pregnancy and all this stuff. But basically, that's what we want to go by. Usually in Southern California, that's smaller than most of my patients want to go. So then we have sizers that were engineered. We happen to use Allergan sizers, but we also have Mentor sizers. But they were engineered to look like approximately like that volume implant will inside your body.
Oh.
Using the regular sizers that we use in the operating room, or some people use, I no longer use them, is not very accurate. And you have, it just doesn't look right. Mm-hmm. But these were made to look pretty much like you will. They're not perfect. Nothing's perfect. You don't know what you want in your mind. And you won't know if you're happy with it until you've had it for a few months. And you're going to go up and down. You like it, you don't. It's fine. It's not. But we put the sizers in the bra and we put a shirt on and people get to look in the mirror and they get to own the result for a minute.
Yeah. So you actually are wearing it.
Right. I stay in there for the sizing. I do not leave it up to Ruth, even though she's been with me for 18 years and she knows. I want to see that look on their face.
Ah, because then you'll know what they really like.
I start lower than I think they want and I go up until we see that little light go on and they they just resonate with what they see in the mirror and it shows in their face. And even with a mask on, you can see it. In their eyes and know, okay, we're in the ballpark. Mm-hmm. And then we start getting into the more intricate things, profiles. Those are hard for people to understand. But profiles are a way we can, if patient picks out a larger volume, we can adjust by using different profiles. We can get one that fits closest to or close enough to their base, you know, inside their base width. But people don't understand, like we talk about high profile. High profile doesn't mean that it comes up higher on their chest. In fact, it comes lower on their chest.
Oh.
Because what it means is if you're looking at the implant sitting on the counter, which of course is not how it is when it's in your body, it has a smaller base diameter. So the circle is smaller, but it projects more. So it means it's going to go in and out on your breast and up less and stick out more than a wider profile implant. So the higher or fuller the profile, the narrower the base and the more projection they get. And if they want bigger breasts, you need a smaller footprint that, especially if they pick a larger size, you need to get the smallest footprint you can to fit behind their breasts. And sometimes their breasts are so closely spaced and we can't put them further than the edge of the breastbone. You need that smaller base. So that's where profiles can come into play. If somebody's breasts are farther apart, then sometimes we can use a wider profile because then it reaches towards the center more and it also reaches up higher, but it also reaches to the side more if your breasts are already far apart. There is no perfect implant. I know there's an implant called the ideal implant, which I think is fabulous marketing, but it is not the ideal implant. It's just a saline implant.
Oh, interesting.
it has baffles in it, like those old waterbeds that I'm old enough to remember and you probably aren't. I use saline implants when my patients say I'm afraid of silicone. Then we'll use saline. I have no problem with that. But given the choice, we'll always use silicone because I feel it looks and feels more natural and it just stands up. It just has better performance than a saline implant, which tends to stretch the skin more. So I really hate putting it in a young girl because it's going to stretch out her tissues.
Oh.
And it's just not going to be good for them.
Mm-hmm.
I went through the 90s. You and I went through the 90s when we could only use saline implants.
Right, right.
Now, since silicone came back in 2006, and so we're seeing all those women we were putting the saline in, now I'm seeing patients that have to have them exchanged or they've deflated or life has happened and they need their breasts lifted or whatever. But their tissues are just stretched out. Because of that water hammer effect of the saline.
Is it because they're heavy or what?
They actually technically are a tiny bit heavier than silicone, but that's not what makes a difference. I think it's because saline is not a cohesive filler. So when you're moving or jogging, it's like a water hammer.
Oh, I see.
silicone is a cohesive and it stays as one piece and it kind of moves differently. It doesn't go up and come down the
slosh
same.
Back down.
Yeah. It doesn't move the same as a silicone. It doesn't stay together. And so I think that may be one part. So I don't want to be putting those in young women especially. But if they say, I'm afraid of silicone, then we get to the issue of, this is supposed to be making you feel better and prettier, not worry that you have bombs in your breasts. And if you're not going to feel comfortable or feel safe with silicone implants, then it's totally defeats the purpose. And I'm not going to try to talk anybody into them and say, they're just as safe and there's all these studies. No, they don't care about that. This isn't about that. It's about how they feel.
Right.
The whole idea of breast augmentation, this is an operation you do not need except to make yourself feel better. So It's all about how you feel. It's how you feel as a woman. It's how you feel just about yourself, your confidence. It's a whole bunch of complex stuff, But it should not be making you feel unsafe.
So there's saline, there's silicone. And now I'm seeing more and more women ask about fat transfers into the breast. Tell me a little bit about that.
Fat transfer to the breast is a good adjunct to breast augmentation in some cases. It will only add about half a cup of volume to your breasts. And it doesn't give you a lot of projection. It will give you more around the edges.
Oh.
So people that have really narrow breasts can often be helped with fat putting it up and around, or people that have what we call constricted or tubular breasts that are short on the bottom, their breast didn't develop on the bottom half. We can put fat in and balance their volume that way.
Mm-hmm.
But to actually do breast augmentation, what most of our patients that ask for fat grafting don't have much fat.
Yeah. Where do you take it from?
And then, you know, they're getting fat from every part of their body. Then you've got to pay for that. And it's only going to give them maybe half a cup. And if you don't have much tissue, the fat, when you put it in there, those fat cells have to get blood supply or they won't survive. Mm. So they have to go in little threads or little amounts and in between the cells that you have in your breast. And there used to be a product or a device called Brava that was basically like a huge suction cup for your breast. And you could wear, you wore these things like hours and hours and hours, most of the day, and only took them off for a few hours a day, but they expanded the tissues and they used them for people's breasts to get larger. But when we first started doing fat grafting, the guy that did these Brava machines, he was on board with that very quickly. And he found that the fat survived better because that suction that the breast had been under pulled the cells kind of apart. So when you put the fat in, it had more room to go around all the cells and in all these little nooks and crannies because they'd been pulled apart and fill those out and get the blood supply that they needed to survive. So you can't just put a lake of fat in there because it's going to die. So the bottom line is you need some breast tissue there and you can only put so much in to the amount of tissue that's there. So if you don't have very much breast tissue to begin with, you're not going to be able to put a whole lot of fat in there at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can opt to do them serially, do several sessions of fat grafting, which is expensive and it's a lot more recovery.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, I think at this point, I like it best for situations of improving the shape and the proportions of the breast, not augmenting the breast itself.
Interesting. So you mentioned Allergan implants or Mentor. Does it depend on the patient which type of implant you might choose? Or is it more within that product line that you would say, oh, Allergan has 5 implants and this is the one that might be best for you?
Well, during my 30 years, I've been able to spend time using all the company's implants, Mentor, Sientra, and Allergan. which used to be McGann, and it was Meta. You know, it's been a lot of things, but right now it's Allergan, and it's been around as long as the other two, but they don't all perform the same. And I like some others better than others. We used to use a lot of mentors. As you know, that was the company that we used predominantly in the beginning in the 2000s. But when the 10-year study data came out on their silicone implants, and that was just a couple of years ago, it turned out that they had a 25% 10-year rupture rate. So 25% of their silicone implants ruptured in the first 10 years.
Oh, wow.
Whereas the other two companies were around 8 or 9%. So there was a significant difference. Mm-hmm. And because we'd been using Mentor for a number of years, we have seen a lot of them back. So now when I do see somebody back that's had Mentor implants for a long time, I want to do an ultrasound on them now that we have the ultrasound in the office to see if that implant is still intact. Mm-hmm. Not that it's a problem to the patient if it's not intact, but it certainly changes how surgery is going to go because we're going to have to be taking out all that silicone and scrubbing and doing a lot of more steps that we need to do to get all that silicone out of the pocket. So it's nice to know if they're ruptured ahead of time. So either Allergan or Sientra are, they're comparable in the way they perform, but Mentor does not perform as well as those two. So for myself, I've excluded Mentor from my game plan. And sometimes patients come in and they've actually, I'm amazed at the amount of research people do online. I've had people come in and say, I've looked at all the data. They've looked at the 10-year study data.
Wow.
They've looked. I mean, I had one woman who was in worked for the company that processed or crunched all the data from all three companies' study protocols. But I've had other patients say, I've read about all of them, and I want this implant. I want Sientra, or I want Allergan. They know the numbers.
They know. Interesting.
And so I feel some people think they're not commodities. They do perform a little bit differently. They have different fill volumes. There's a lot of very subtle aspects that probably most patients wouldn't notice in the least. But I like paying attention to that and looking at them.
So if you're a patient who doesn't want to read all the studies, that's why we come to you, because you've already done it. Right. So we don't have to feel like we have to go off on into the internet black holes to read the study.
No, that's what you're supposed to be depending on your surgeon for, is, no, it's my job to know how these perform and to pay attention to how they look and how patients experience them and the subtleties of the differences. And so I make it a point to do that.
Now, I remember back in the day, people were talking about capsular contracture. And so basically, if the implant gets hard and everybody was trying to figure out it's, you know, smooth outside or a textured or under the muscle and over the muscle, where does all that stand right now? And what are the rates that people might have a capsular contracture?
You know, when I first went into practice, the capsular contracture rate was like 30 to 50%, depending on the study that you looked at. It was a lot. And it drove us nuts. And a lot of people had ideas about it could be this, it could be that. That's where the oldest wives' tale of breast augmentation, as far as I'm concerned, came up. You need to massage the breast. You need to keep the breast pocket really big. No, you don't. There has never, ever been a study that proved that or even studied it. But what happens, what I explain to patients is that when I do a procedure now, and I learned part of this because Sientra sent me to Sweden to work with a man over there that had 20 years of the most minute data of every aspect of breast augmentation, and he had it down cold. I came back and started adding all the things that he had taught me, and it makes a difference. And one of the things I learned is that you want to put the implant exactly where it belongs. And so that's why I don't use sizers anymore. I do the sizing ahead of time and I say, okay, this is the implant, this is the size, this is the profile, this is what we're going to use. And then on the day of surgery, I mark exactly where that implant belongs on their chest. If I have to lower the fold, I do that. You know, it has to be sort of in the middle of their breast. Mm-hmm. And I mark it exactly. I go in there, make an incision under the breast. We used to make them all around the areola, or people say the nipple, has a much higher capsular contracture rate. Another story. But I make a house for that implant that is snug. It fits nicely. Mm-hmm. And then your body's going to start forming a capsule scar tissue around that space.
Which is normal, right?
It's forming it around the space. Okay. Now the space happens to be around the implant, but the capsule is forming against the tissues. If it's a textured implant, they are in close contact, but it's responding to the presence of the implant by creating a capsule of scar tissue around the implant, the space that it's in. That's a normal foreign body response. If you got a BB or a splinter under your skin, or you have a pacemaker put in, your body does the same thing. It makes a little scar tissue capsule and walls it off from the rest of the body and holds it tight just where it is, separates it. It takes 4 to 6 months or longer for that capsule to be what we call mature and have the most strength it's going to have. So sometimes when it's developing, it gets contractile fibers in it somehow develop. And then that capsule, because it's got circular fibers around this round implant or even around a shaped implant, it can contract and it squeezes on the implant, sort of like you're squeezing on a balloon, and it's the breast starts feeling really hard and it looks really round because the smallest surface area for volume is round. And it usually pulls up in the breast and looks higher and it can begin to hurt. So that was happening really a lot in the beginning of my practice. And since then, we've learned a lot of things. The first thing we learned, as I remember it, is that smooth implants over the muscle have a higher capsular contracture rate. So when textured came around the end of the 80s, early 90s, well, actually, we had the MEMS, the polyurethane covered implants before that. And the reason we got textured silicone implants is that the polyurethane implants, covered implants, had the least number of capsular contractures and the softest breasts. They felt and looked the most natural. So everybody thought, okay, well, it must be the foam and the texture. It disorganizes the capsule as it forms. Let's texture the outside of the silicone implants. Just imprint it or add it, or there's different ways of making the surface textured. And they found that over the muscle, the capsular contracture rate with textured implants was lower than it was with smooth implants. Hmm. But then we started putting most implants under the muscle, and the capsular contracture rate for smooth and textured was about the same.
And you went under the muscle for most people. Why?
Well, in young or thin people, it just gives you better coverage in the part of your breast that you see in a lot of clothing. Oh. And so it just softens the look of the breast. So if you're really thin, or if I have a young girl who's not had kids and has small breasts, I don't want to go over the muscle on her because I don't know what's going to happen to her breasts when she has kids. And so that was the first thing we learned. We also learned things bit by bit. Then the biofilm came out about, a theory came out about 10 years ago that there's these little biofilms are everywhere.
Is it something that your body makes or?
No, it's a colony. It's a neighborhood of bacteria, usually more than one. They live in a neighborhood and it's a gated community. The bacteria actually secrete a fence around the colony or the neighborhood so that they're flying under the radar of your immune system doesn't recognize it. Oh. And so they don't cause these overt infections, but they can cause problems. And so there's a theory that biofilm forms inside this pocket around the implant and that can cause capsular contracture. So over the years, there have been all these theories and they came up with a number of years ago, I think it was Sienter that came up with the 14 steps that you can use in handling the implant during surgery that really cuts down on the capsular contracture rate, which we use. Even things like putting an occlusive dressing over the nipple at the beginning of procedure, because the ducts in your breast have bacteria because they're there to see a newborn's gut. Mm. That's why it's there. Well, that doesn't mean we want it around our implants.
True.
So they found that when you're manipulating the breast during a breast augmentation, you can express bacteria out of the ducts through the nipple. And likewise, if you're cutting right below the nipple and going down directly through the breast, you're cutting through ducts and you're releasing bacteria. And so biofilm theory, here you are. So now we put these occlusive dressings over the nipple in the beginning of the procedure, and I don't use perirealer incisions very often. And that cut down the capsular contracture rate just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And we found betadine. There was a while, betadine's bad for the implant. No, it's not bad for the implant. Oh, guess what? It actually cuts down the bacterial load in the pocket. So now we're using betadine again. Well, now you have to soak the implants for 5 minutes at least in betadine before you use them, which is why another reason I make patients decide what implant we're using, because I show them the box. Here are your implants. We go through the number, the profile, the shape, everything. These are your implants. And we take them directly into the operating room and they get opened as soon as the instruments are open before surgery even starts. They barely open the package that they're in and pour betadine in there and cover the implant. Mm. So it's like 15 minutes before we are using those implants. Then we have the Keller funnels that look like pie funnels that...
Yeah, or like icing if you were icing a cake with a decorative tip.
Well, we have really fancy, expensive ones that we use for the implants. And it's called a no-touch technique. And we change our gloves and we put pocket mints in, and there's just 14 steps we go through. But some of them include, one of them is using inframammary incisions, or breast under infra, meaning under mammary, the breast in the fold. Because then, you know, go just a little tiny distance and you're right where you need to be. You're right on the muscle. You cut through a little bit of the muscle and you're boom, you're under there. You're not into the breast at all. So we're not releasing ducts. We're not doing anything like that. You're just boom, you're right there. So that's one of the 14 steps. So doing all these steps has reduced our capsular contracture rate to around 2 to 5%.
Wow, that's amazing. And each little thing, if it's 2% here and 1% there, and all of a sudden,
because there was a time that I just wanted to give up because it seemed like half the cases I was doing were revisions for capsular contractures. And at that time, we didn't have a good answer for capsular contractures, because if you got one, you had, you know, a greater chance of getting another. Then if you got another, you got even more. And each time you were taking out that capsule and doing a capsulectomy and everything, you were taking a little bit of breast tissue and that you lost a little bit of volume. And you just got people that had so many capsule removals, their tissues were really bad. We didn't have a good answer for them. And then we got the ADMs, the acellular dermal matrices, 12, 15 years ago, Dr. Smith and I started using them. And we found that people who had capsular contractures, that it really reduced the rate of capsular contractures. Whereas before, every time you would get one, the chance of you getting another went up. Then all of a sudden, boom, it was down to just a few percent.
Yeah. And he and I recorded an episode about secondary augmentation or revisions. And we talked about that. So back to the patient who, you know, this is a first time thing. So we talked about the incisions. How long are they under anesthesia?
For me, having done thousands of them, I can do a normal, uncomplicated breast augmentation first time in about half an hour, but you got to put the patient to sleep. You got to put on the dressings. You got to wake them up. So all told, they're asleep maybe an hour.
Okay. So not long.
No, not at all. And then they're in recovery. But the nice thing, a lot of women having augmentations for the first time are younger and they've never been put to sleep before. So they're really worried about,
what's that going to be like?
And if they're mothers, they're young mothers, especially if they're single moms, what if I don't wake up? And that's very rare. But I tell the patients, we have board certified anesthesiologists who have been with us for as long as I've been there. And they're all handpicked, excellent. They've all done cardiac anesthesia. They all know what they're doing. They know how to handle emergency. Our staff is ACLS certified. They know how to handle an emergency. We're right next to the hospital. And it's going to be fine. We're going to keep you safe. And for the first time patients, they're thinking, oh, is it going to hurt? Or am I really going to be asleep? You know, they imagine it's like they go to bed at night. No, you're unconscious. And to you, it will seem like you blinked your eyes. You will not know you're going to sleep and you will not know you're waking up. It will be literally you open your eyes and you're in recovery.
Uh-huh.
All that time, we're going to be monitoring everything going in and out of your body and keeping you safe.
Mm-hmm. And that's really a key differentiator. I mean, the operating room is accredited. So it's set up just like a hospital. We have dedicated circulating nurses. You have anesthesiologists, board certified, many of them multi-board certified. And so for anybody who hasn't met Dr. Saltz before, there's two Dr. Saltzes at our center. Dr. Saltz's husband, Stephen Saltz, is one of our anesthesiologists. And he's got 4 board certifications.
Yep, including critical care.
So he is the one to trust. And, you know, each of the doctors, whether you have Dr. Haas or Dr. Young, whoever in our group, that's been the same group for the whole time I've been at the center and the whole time you've been at the center, which is really nice. It's not some stranger coming into the OR. And they pre-vet the patients. I mean, they look at the charts ahead of time, making sure that they don't see anything that could be alarming in any way.
In fact, it happened to me, my husband picked up on a patient recently. It was just a breast dog, I thought. He was having trouble with her blood pressures and didn't think the cuff was working. So he and Danielle were moving the cuff all around and he was taking it several times. And he was not happy with it about it because the pressure in the upper limb was so much different than in the lower limb. And they did all these shenanigans again in the recovery room. And he ended up saying, you know, I think maybe your doctor will think I'm crazy, but you need to go to the doctor soon and you need to have your heart looked at because I think you have something called a coarctation, which is a constricture of the aorta after the aortic valve, but it's after the blood vessels that go off to your upper limbs and before the ones that go to your lower limbs. And so the blood pressures are different in your upper and lower limbs. It can be a severe problem. It can lead to death. And she's like 30. She went in and by God, she had coarct and she was on the schedule.
Oh my goodness.
For her heart surgery.
Wow.
You know, just, I mean, but that's the kind of quality our anesthesiologists have in picking up problems. This is a problem he picked up during surgery.
Wow.
And managed it and told her and actually she got taken care of.
That's amazing.
So they're good.
Yeah, they're really good. And some of the other questions people might have is if you're a first-time breast dog patient, maybe you haven't had children yet, you say, if I decide to have kids, what will happen to the breast? Can I breastfeed? What happens to the implants? What do they need to know?
Well, speaking from personal and professional experience, if you've never breastfed, you don't know how much or if you can breastfeed in the first place. And you heard me mention constricted breasts before. Those breasts don't produce much milk.
Mm.
And I can't tell you how many patients have come in so frustrated they couldn't breastfeed. And we look at their breasts and go, well, you never could, you know.
Not your fault.
Yeah, it's not your fault. And they go, why didn't nobody ever tell me this? And we said, because they don't really know. So you don't know how much or if you can breastfeed. We do know that there's 5 times more problems breastfeeding if you go in around the areola or the nipple, where some people call it, than if you go underneath. And you don't know, but if we go underneath, we're pretty much not disturbing your breast ducts at all. Most breast ducts that are producing milk are in the upper part of the breast in the first place. So it probably isn't going to affect their ability to breastfeed at all. How their breasts are going to change is really, really variable. I mean, some people's breasts change a lot. And as soon as they get pregnant, they're 2 cup sizes bigger. And other people, their breasts change maybe 1/2 a cup. They don't change much at all. And then it depends on if you breastfeed and how long you breastfeed and how big your breasts got, how engorged they got, how stretched out they got. All these things go into it. So you don't know. You do not know what is going to happen. Now, generally speaking, people who have really small breasts to begin with aren't going to get very big during pregnancy. And Ruth, my nurse, always ask them, well, are you on birth control pills? And what happens to your breasts around your period? So if you're on birth controls or around your period, your breasts get a cup size bigger, then you're probably going to have a bigger change during pregnancy. That means your breasts are hormonally responsive. But if your breasts stay pretty much the same, then probably not going to change tremendously during pregnancy and breastfeeding. But that's not set in stone, but it's sort of a guideline. You don't know. But the thing is, the implants aren't forever. And no, they're not just 10 years. The new warranties are 20 years. Thank you very much.
It used to be the 10-year. That was like, oh God, I got to come in for my 10-year exchange.
And you know what? I've been on the boards for Mentor and Sientra both. And we've asked that question, where did this come from? And they said, we have no clue, except that the warranties used to be 10 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the warranty doesn't mean you go get a new car.
Right. Just when the warranty is up doesn't mean it's not right. Useful.
That means you're going to be paying for the service. So pretty much that's what the warranty was, but it was 10 years. And so people thought, the warranty's up, I got to get my implants changed.
Uh-huh.
No. And now the warranties are 20 years. Okay. So now we should start hearing, oh, in 20 years, I have to get an implant. No, if they're not broken, do not fix them.
Right. Because you have to outweigh the risk of surgery, any kind of surgery. You know, if everything's fine, then why cause a trauma? So, you know, they talk about implant settling. You know, at the beginning, I would say they're probably more swollen, right? And maybe more tight. Or how would you describe that initial period?
That's a really good question because I learned to do things a little bit differently. When we put them under the muscle, your muscle wants to lie flat against your chest. That's where it's been your whole life. And so it's a strong muscle. You use it all the time. It's going to be smashing your implant flat against your chest. So it's going to look flat and it's going to look wide and high. Mm. And sometimes for reasons I don't completely understand, square. And that muscle's tight and that muscle is going to cramp. And that's where a lot of the pain comes from after surgery. So what I have my patients doing is putting their arms up straight over their head, stretching that muscle. Every marathon runner knows that the next day you stretch and stretch and stretch. So 5 times an hour, they're putting their arms up over their head and I have them taking muscle relaxants because we want that muscle and the muscle is holding that implant up there. And you want that muscle to relax. And as it does over the first few weeks, the implants can start to, quote, settle and come down into a teardrop shape. So the volume gets less on top and more on the bottom, and you get that teardrop shape that everybody wants. Mm-hmm. But it takes a couple of months. Even at 2 weeks, they feel a lot better. Ruth, my nurse, tells them, just don't look at them the first week. You won't like them. So look at them the second week.
Hang out. Hang in there.
Just wait. You know, of course, everybody looks. And we look. But it doesn't happen overnight. It happens over a period of weeks that they, quote, settle. And usually by 4 to 6 months, they have, quote, settled as much as they're going to settle.
So when can you go back to like normal activities and when like work, or when can you go back to going to the gym or for a run?
Now, I said I make that pocket just the precise size for your implant and you don't have a capsule right away. And so your muscle is when it pushes on that implant, when you contract it, it's going to push the implant down and out perpendicular to the fibers of the muscle. And so I don't want my patients exercising for this at all for the first 6 weeks. And then I don't let them do chest exercises isolated or activities like surfing for 6 months. Not because I'm mean. I want that capsule to form around the precise space that I made for that particular implant. And once it's stable and, quote, we said mature, you won't be able to move your implant out of place. Then you can do whatever you want. And the body is what it is. The healing process, the maturation of the scar tissue, it is what it is. So I tell patients after 2 weeks, you can go back to exercising except for your chest. You know, they can do biceps and triceps. Ruth is a workout freak, as you know. So she goes through all the exercises and things they can do with them. And I tell them, it's up to you. If you want to do things at 2 weeks, go ahead and do them. But if the implant gets displaced, we have a problem. And neither one of us is going to like it. So you choose what you want to do with your investment. And just, it's your choice.
Now, if they're at a desk job or something sort of sedentary, then I would assume they could go back to work when they feel ready, maybe in 4 to 5 days.
A lot of people do go back in 4 and 5 days. And now with the pandemic still going on and a lot of people working from home, they're back at work in 2 days because they don't have to get up and drive someplace and go through all. They just get out of bed and they work. A lot of them are accountants or they're not interacting face to face with people. They can work for as long as they want and go take a nap and then come back. But they're back to work in a couple of days.
But if you are in a job where you're lifting something, what do you say in terms of you can't lift anything heavier than what for how long?
Although they say like 1/2 gallon of milk. But let's be real. A lot of these women have young children, need to be picked up. And if they're toddlers, so they're on their feet, I tell them you need to bend down like you're supposed to, and nobody does, and put them on your hip and stand up using your thighs, you know, your legs to come up. Don't bend over and use your arms to pick up the baby. But when they're in a crib, that's a different story. Now, then they don't weigh very much. And you can say, you know, within a week or so, they're going to be picking up the baby, whether you tell them that they can or not. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
But I tell them getting them in and out of the crib. Nowadays, my days, you could lift the crib, the sides down, but now you can't. So you have to get up and over. So I said, somebody, either older sibling or your husband, or you need to get a little step stool that you can get up, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, the kid that's 10, 12 pounds, you're going to be picking him up in 4 or 5 days. You just are. There's no, let's not joke with each other.
But the risk of, you know, if you pick up something too heavy is that they could get a little hematoma, right? Which is like a little bleeder or...
Right. That's true. You can do nothing and get a hematoma. But well, yes, doing more. And there are different ways of picking things up. If you pick things up straight up with your biceps, you're not using your chest muscles at all. But there's other ways of picking things up. When you reach out and pick things up, that you can feel your chest muscles engage. Those are the ones that are a problem. So I tell my hairdressers, because they are working with their hands all day, I said, you've got to put your clients down lower and you have to think about keeping your elbows closer to your body when you're doing your blowouts and your cutting and stuff like that. You just have to think about how you're doing things and adjust a little bit for a while and you can do them. It's just how you do them.
Right. Interesting.
And so I feel if I tell patients what they're thinking about and why, they figure it out.
So one of the things that I think patients don't really always know where to start is, you know, how do we choose a good surgeon if they're not in San Diego? Let's say, what should they look for? What would you recommend people look for?
Well, obviously board certification by the American Board of Plastic Surgery. This is something that so many patients get tricked by, and how long they've been in practice can be some guide to it. Obviously, I can tell you that the longer you've been in practice and the more you pay attention, the more you learn over the years. But the other thing is, how many other things do they do? What do they do primarily? Because most of us, we like doing more, some things more than other things. Like you remember, I cannot stand breaking bones. And
so she did not want to do noses.
I did not want to do noses. And when Dr. Olson was in there, tap, 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 breaking the nose bones, I just, no. So I never did noses. And I really don't like face work. It just makes me nervous. And I'm just not, I don't feel comfortable. It's just not my thing. Other people don't like doing breasts. Other people don't like doing body work. They want to do hand work. Or we all have something we do more than others. And I think I'm better limiting what I do to what I really like and what I can really focus on. Because I spend a lot of time reading and going to focused meetings, board meetings with the implant companies that pertain to what I like to do best. And I think that is a benefit. But another thing is to go to their gallery and look and see what kind of results are they getting. Because mm-hmm. I like a real natural look. Other people, they're like really huge breasts. And that's what they go for.
Yeah.
And I get a little uncomfortable when people ask me for something I'm not really comfortable doing. I'll tell them, you know, it's not really what I like doing. I'll try to do my best for you. But I think you really have to look at their results and see what they like.
And you can look for something. I think with breasts, you look for somebody who's maybe shaped like you are, mm-hmm. right? Because breasts come in so many different shapes.
Well, that's why I took, when I did my gallery, I took the same set of patients and I divided them up separately. I put them in there based on height, because a lot of people say, well, I'm tall and I need bigger breasts. And then I based them on volume. So they're just sorted differently, one by height, one by volume. Actually, what I wish I could do is by chest circumference, because I think your breasts need to be in balance with how big your chest is. So you might have a big back end and a narrow chest. And if you put big booms on it, you're going to look like that Veronica in the old comic books, you know, just, it has to be balanced. But yeah, patients go through the galleries, because I put on my own gallery, the ones I did, I put how tall they were, how many kids they had, how much they weighed, all that stuff. And people do go through it and pick out, this girl looks the closest to me.
Yeah. And I think, don't you think that's way more accurate than trying to bring in something from a magazine or showing somebody's Instagram of some celebrity and going, I like those boobs. You know, yeah. that's not how it works.
Actually, I really don't like seeing photos out of magazines and stuff, because usually the people, the celebrities or the models or whoever, they're in a bathing suit, they're in clothing, they're in some sexy dress. And those clothing has all kinds of ways of magic, smoke and mirrors mm-hmm. to make your breasts look better.
Not to mention the filters in Photoshop.
Right.
You don't know what you're looking at.
You don't know what you're looking at. So I tell patients, well, should I bring in photos? And I said, if you do, I want you to bring in naked photos, good photos. And so what you need to do is go through my galleries, go through other people's galleries, go through galleries and look at real before and after photos and come in and tell me, this is what I want to look like. Then they're naked. I can see the shape. Sometimes patients are looking at shape more than there are spacing or, you know, things that we may not have control over.
Right. Because of the anatomy.
Right. Yeah. And so if they bring in somebody whose breasts are way far apart and they want cleavage, you have to sit there and say, I can't make you look exactly like that because your anatomy is not like that. Mm-hmm. So photos for me are only good if they're naked photos.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We'll put in the show notes links to Dr. Saltz's profile, links to the gallery. We'll put in links to, you know, learning more about breast augmentation. So you can see that and you can see all of her reviews. She's got over 1,300 reviews from her patients on our website. And so thank you all. And thank you, Dr. Saltz. And we will catch you next time.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Moni.
Bye.
Take a screenshot of this podcast episode with your phone and show it at your consultation or appointment, or mention the promo code PODCAST to receive $25 off any service or product of $50 or more at La Jolla Cosmetic. La Jolla Cosmetic is located just off the I-5 San Diego Freeway in the ZyMed building on the Scripps Memorial Hospital campus. To learn more, go to ljcsc.com or follow the team on Instagram at ljcsc. The La Jolla Cosmetic Podcast is a production of The Axis, THEAXIS.io.